Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. If you've been following our sister websites, newspapers, and magazines over the past few months, you've hopefully seen the debate playing out about the future of the Canadian seed sector, specifically the potential amalgamation of five, count them, five seed industry groups. That includes the Canadian Plant Technology Agency, Commercial Seed Analysts Association of Canada, Canadian Seed Institute, Canadian Seed Trade Association, and of course, the Canadian Seed Growers Association. Well, members of these groups have spoken, and the outcome was, shall we say, less than unanimous. Reporter Alan Dawson has been following this whole process for the Manitoba Cooperator, and he joins us now. Alan, welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
So first, let's catch everyone up on the background here. These associations have been talking about a merger for a really long time now, and you know the top brass in those groups seem to feel that it's a good idea. What's the logic been behind an amalgamation?
You're right. The discussions have been going on for about 5 years, and a lot of the pros that have been pointed out include having a single window of for the seed sector, getting everybody in one building, one room, so to speak, and being able to communicate better, build consensus around seed issues, and this would. The thinking is this would help in dealing with the federal government, which regulates the seed sector under the Seeds Act. Now with the different groups, specifically, especially the Seed Growers and the Seed Trade Associations being the biggest two and the ones with the most members, sometimes they might have slightly different policies on something, and so bringing everybody into the same organization was thought would streamline things, maybe save some money. There was a bit of overlap on membership, especially between the Seed Trade Association and Seed Growers Association. Some seed growers are members of the Seed Trade Association. So, yeah, those are some of the main reasons of pulling things together, streamlining, you know, that single window of service, and bringing the seed sector, you know, totally together and having sort of a consensus building from you know, having everybody in the same organization.
Well, that seems fair. Everybody likes to hear about a decent cost-saving bundle, but the op-ed pages in the Cooperator and elsewhere have also had plenty of ink with various parties explaining why they feel this is a bad idea. So what are the main concerns against?
Well, from the seed growers' perspective, and some in the Seed Trade Association have had some concerns too. But both groups, seed growers, of course, passed it, as you mentioned. Seed Trade Association rather passed it, as well as the other three groups, but seed growers didn't. And seed growers had a concern with around the governance. Potential fee increases in Seeds Canada, which was the name that was going to be given to the merged group. But I was just talking to somebody, the Seed Trade Association is president, and she was saying that some people in the Seed Trade Association shared some of the concerns that seed growers had about membership fees and governance, that sort of thing. But amongst the seed growers, in talking to them, some of the people on the no side, the people that were opposed to merging, it really boils down to concern about the voice of the seed grower being diminished and the potential that in a unified Seeds Canada with the seed trade, that the seed industry, some of the big companies which are members of the Seed Trade Association, like your Bayers and Syngentas and BASF and those people that are also producing seeds, that those companies might diminish the authority power of the seed grower, and that seems to be a concern. As one pro side seed grower said to me, that the no side was framing it as a David versus Goliath, the little guy versus the big guy, and the concern about that seems to have resonated, and the outcome is that the seed growers members voted down this proposal. They required 2/3 majority to pass it, and it worked out that about 751 seed growers voted, and 414 or 55% opposed, 45% were in favor. So it wasn't a big gap, between the no and the yes side, slightly higher for the no side, but a long way from, the 2/3 that was required. So it wasn't even a simple majority, never mind a 2/3, to get it passed.
And that's interesting too. I mean, normally when groups or even companies announce these sort of mergers or amalgamations, they're usually reasonably sure that the wedding's going to go off as planned. I mean, was anybody really surprised that the CSGA membership, which again is mostly sort of is mostly sort of farm gate level farmers, was anyone surprised that the CSGA membership would be less than in favor?
Well, I initially was thinking that it would, my own sort of just hunch was that this was going to pass, but a week before the vote, I was talking to some people in the industry, and they were saying to me that there was a view out there that this thing was going to be lost, and that week and a few weeks before, the no side was really building momentum, sending out letters, emails, and so on to members, urging them to vote against it. So there was an inkling that it wasn't going to be a slam dunk and that it might not pass. But certainly the people that were supporting it, including those one of the members of the national board from Manitoba, Eric McLean, certainly expressed deep disappointment that it didn't pass, and I think initially there was momentum, but then there was a strong pushback based on some of these concerns around governance and what it might mean for the seed growers. Another point I should make is that I think my view is, talking to some people, there's some, Canadian Seed Growers Association has been around for more than 100 years. There's a lot of pride there in the organization. I think maybe that played into a little bit, but just the uncertainty, I suppose, around making major change and what it might mean. The Eric McLean and others that were on the S side feel like the no side was maybe creating a boogeyman a bit, concern about canola, which was once a seed crop for regular seed growers and was a good crop for seed growers. And of course, seed growers are still doing it, but it's all based in Alberta and controlled largely by the companies. And so there seemed to be this fear about company control, taking more control of the seed industry and pedigreed seed, and that seemed to really rally the no side.
So what happens now? I mean, can this amalgamation, this marriage, even go ahead with fewer than five parties on board?
Yeah, there's a possibility, probably a fairly good one, when I was speaking to the Sea Trade Association. And things are still in a state of flux. It's probably fair to say the seed growers themselves, the association's still in a bit of dismay, a bit of shock. It's going to be meeting soon, its board, to discuss things further. And the other associations are talking too. But there's a willingness amongst the four to create Seeds Canada and to go ahead. even without the seed growers. And there was talk as an alternative to merging, having a memorandum of understanding, an MOU. So, you know, one scenario would see the four merge, create Seeds Canada, and then work out some sort of arrangement with the seed growers to try and accomplish some of the things that they wanted to accomplish around consensus building and streamlining things. And one, you know, further to that scenario is, if that did happen, you know, over time, maybe the seed growers and this new group, Seeds Canada, would be working together, and who knows, maybe in the future, look at becoming part of Seeds Canada. That's a possibility that people are talking about now. So, yeah, that's, as president of the Seed Trade Association told me, the momentum in terms of at least the four that voted in favor of merging has not stopped.
And that's interesting too. I mean, because would there still be much of a point to a Seeds Canada organization without the CSGA on board?
Well, the four remaining, the four groups that voted in favor of merging, I think there would be. Would be worthwhile. It certainly wouldn't be quite as encompassing as it would have had it included the seed growers. And the seed growers have the statutory authority to actually, they're the ones that are doing the seed certification now. And so Seeds Canada wouldn't be doing that without the seed growers being part of it. But perhaps through an MOU or some sort of arrangement, there could be some streamlining and more cooperation brought to bear.
Well, we know that you've been talking to various players in these organizations, and we look forward to seeing your coverage of it in an upcoming issue of the Manitoba Cooperator and elsewhere. Alan Dawson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Alan Dawson is a reporter for the Manitoba Cooperator at Miami, Manitoba. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Next up, we're going to take a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Here's Grain News editor Carrie Belanger speaking with Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston.
Hi, everyone. I'm Carrie Belanger, and I'm the editor of Grain News. And today I'm here with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at your fall fertility program by combining sulfur and phosphorus applications. Christy, welcome.
Thank you, Carrie.
Now, Christy, the last time we talked about fertilizer management, you mentioned more farmers are considering fall applications of sulfur. Are they also shifting to other nutrients such as phosphorus in the fall? And is it for those same reasons?
That's actually a great question, Carrie. And for most farmers, phosphorus applications in the fall came first. So phosphorus is an immobile nutrient in the soil. And what that means is if you get a large rainfall event, the phosphorus is not going to be lost. It's going to be available next spring if it's applied this fall. We are seeing more farmers applying sulfur this fall, but they have to be aware of the source that they use. The sulfate form of sulfur is leachable, and therefore, if it is leached from the soil profile, it's not plant available. And so maybe sticking with an elemental form would be a better option.
What are the advantages of applying both sulfur and phosphorus at the same time?
A lot of times it comes down to management practices. If I can do anything in the fall, say apply fertilizer in the fall, and that frees up some time in the spring, since timing may be constrained due to weather events, when my number one goal is to get the plant in the ground, then anything that I can do this fall to make sure that the nutrients are there next spring is going to be a great resource for increasing my ROI as a farmer.
And are there any benefits with respect to plant uptake of the actual nutrients?
So when we think about applying more nutrients at the same time, there is some benefit Definitely if the plant's uptaking a lot of one particular nutrient. So say phosphorus, for example, the seedling stage of say a corn plant needs that phosphorus to get going. But it also needs sulfur at the same time too. So we do see some interactions there where one nutrient has to be available to maximize the other one. So there is a benefit to applying, say, a multi-nutrient fertilizer product or having a fertilizer product that is capable of being blended with other fertilizers, like say urea or additional MAP. There's always some good options.
How do the fall applications compare to spring applications when we're talking about the availability of plant nutrients? And also, have we covered the forms that both the sulfur and the phosphorus would take?
Phosphorus is present as phosphate in most fertilizers. Sulfur can be present as sulfate or elemental sulfur. Now, when we talk about fall applications, if a fall application of sulfate's made, it may not necessarily be plant available come spring whenever the plant's actively growing, because the sulfate fertilizers carry a high leaching potential. When it comes to comparing fall versus spring applications, a lot of times we see similar yields as long as farmers follow a few general guidelines. So say choosing the right source, maybe choosing an elemental form of sulfur because the oxidation required to make the sulfur plant available into the sulfate form. And also at the same time, waiting for application after the soils begin to cool down. So it's a general guideline for applications of nitrogen and sulfur in the fall that soil temperatures drop below, say, 10 degrees Celsius. Below that point, microbial processes slow down. So any process within the soil that is driven by microbes, so say the oxidation of elemental sulfur, those processes are going to slow down. And that's going to allow for, say, your sulfur to be available next spring because it's not being oxidized by the microbes.
And are there any risks to applying these types of products in the fall, ones where you're combining phosphate and sulfur?
So one thing that a farmer might need to consider about fall application, and we've already talked a lot about source, but making sure that you stick with, say, an elemental sulfur source so that it is there and available next spring whenever the plant is actively growing. But one thing to consider is in some of these growing conditions where, say, in Western Canada, the soil temperatures don't necessarily warm up. And we do see a lot of, say, phosphorus deficiency. So if you do make a fall application, we do also suggest that you might apply, say, a starter fertilizer that contains both a phosphorus source and a sulfur as sulfate, so that the plant is definitely not limited in the springtime. If you've, say, applied an elemental sulfur in the fall, then that sulfate should be available next spring after the soils warm up above a certain temperature. But by incorporating a starter fertilizer, you're ensuring that that phosphorus and sulfur is near the plant, it's available, and it can be taken up, and you can maximize your production that way.
That's a great explanation. Do you have any recommendations for blends? How much AMS would you put down then in that situation in the spring where there are cooler soils?
So for cooler growing conditions, we do recommend that a farmer look at their total sulfur and, well, pretty much their sulfur needs for that particular plant that they're trying to grow, and consider applying a blend of, say, ammonium sulfate and Nutrien has a new product called Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST, where the sulfur is present as micronized sulfur technology, or MST, as the elemental form. Right. And by combining the two sources, you're ensuring that there is sulfur readily available to the plant, but also you'll have that slow release or that longer term availability from elemental sulfur because it has to be oxidized before it's plant available.
And of course, so you mentioned that it's a blend MAP plus MST, so it's got the phosphorus in there as well.
Exactly. Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST carries a fertilizer grade of 943016. So it definitely has a high concentration of both phosphorus and sulfur. And it also offers versatility with fall or spring applications. And it's also a great product for blending in high humid areas, say with urea.
Now, if farmers or agronomists want more information on this, where can they find it?
Farmers and agronomists can definitely find more information on smartnutritionmst.com.
Thanks so much, Christy. And thank you, audience, for listening to this special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Join us again next time for a discussion on soil versus plant mobility and what that means in terms of sulfur deficiency and uptake all season long.
You've been listening to Grain News editor Carrie Belanger with Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston, and you're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. You've probably heard the old expression, usually attributed to Mark Twain, "Buy land, they're not making it anymore." That's certainly true, but way up in northern Ontario, we may be seeing land that's already made that's now getting a reboot for the new millennium. Stu Slater is an Ontario dairy farmer and farm writer who's been writing about this and other ag issues in Farmtario, and he joins us now on the line from St. Mary's. Stu, hello and welcome to Between the Rows.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my first time on, so it's pretty exciting.
We're really glad to have you. Let's start with the geography of this area. If I've opened up Google Maps or something and I have a map of Ontario in front of me, where is the region we're talking about here?
If you find Toronto pretty easily, and then you start driving north, and if you first 3 hours north of Toronto, you go through what we call a cottage country down here, Muskoka, Parry Sound area. Then you get to North Bay, and that's close to 4 hours, I guess, north of Toronto. And then we think of ourselves as being in northern Ontario. And there's some farming around North Bay. It's kind of a valley along Lake Nipissing there, and certainly some farm communities there. You keep driving north another hour and a half, you get to New Liskeard. You go through basically rock and trees and lakes to get there, but then another valley around New Liskeard, which has been a strong area agriculturally in Ontario for a long time. So there's a few communities around there that are the economy is driven to a large degree by agriculture. But then, you know, an hour north of that, you're back into the trees and the rock to a large extent. At least that's been my perspective. The guy that I talked to, economic development officer for two little villages just to the west of Kapuskasing on Highway 11, about 9.5 hours north of Toronto.
Wow.
So that's what we're looking at.
So just to give everyone some background, though, this, you know, even up in Kapuskasing, we're talking about land that's been proven arable in the past, though. Is that correct?
Yeah, they call it the Great Northern Clay Belt down here. It's been classed as prime, as class 1, 2, 3 agricultural land.
Wow.
I guess in the 1950s, there was a push on, sort of a marketing push to have have farmers come up and clear this land. People come up, clear the land, and farm it. I guess some did, because there are some farms in the area. Mm-hmm. It's definitely been proven to be, there's basically millions of acres of what has been classed as class, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 agricultural land in this Great Northern Clay Belt, they call it.
So when we're talking about clay, are we talking about sort of a black soil type of thing, or do we know what sort of soil it is?
I think there's a range, but there's some black soil, but I think more along the lines of heavier ground that not drained the greatest, but there has, I think, ongoing since then, almost since then, been sort of programs, especially since the advent of tile drainage, then there have been programs promoted by the government funding opportunities to that they will cost share the drainage of agricultural land in those regions, and that those programs continue.
Now, during tough times, you know, I've heard farmers warning before that, you know, if they go out of business, you know, who's going to farm the land? You know, it's a fair question, but usually the answer is someone else with either the cash or credit to buy it. But in this particular instance, in this case, I guess the answer really was nobody. I mean, who would abandon perfectly good farmland, and why?
Well, yeah, that was the thing. The understanding, to a great extent, when they started sort of putting the push on for this land, was that people would clear it and then they would farm it. And although perhaps some people did, most people, it seems, didn't. I don't know if it was through the act of clearing the land or whatever, but they kind of came to understand that the timber industry was driving the economy up there to a much later, greater extent than farming. And this is what I was told anyway, that so many of the people that came and bought that land, they may have established themselves there, they didn't farm. They were sort of drawn by the dollars into the timber industry, into the mining camp, or the timber camps, some mining too, but I think from what I understood, it was mostly the timber industry at that time. We're talking about the 1950s, so.
So,
they went there, but they didn't farm.
So if we flash forward to the present date, now who owns this land now?
Well, it could be the descendants of those people. A lot of this land, a vast amount of it, actually was, it was always crown land, or I guess since it was, since the Europeans moved in anyway, is deemed to be crown land. So there's a lot of crown land up there. And then it's been bought up pieces here and there by people from the south, you know, for a cottage property, or from Quebec, you know, even people from Europe that want to have a wilderness, piece of wilderness or something. So,
how hard is it to track these folks down? I mean, if somebody's looking for farmland now, I mean, are they able to actually find the people with the title?
I was told by this this economic development officer that there's privacy legislation that either prevents them from knowing who has title, or from, you know, both, also just prevents them from communicating that information to any interested sellers. So there's just basically sort of red tape roadblocks for them. And in addition to that, with the crown land, there's a lot of red tape in terms of having crown land change the zoning or whatever, so that it can be zoned as agricultural. So there's just a lot of red tape, it sounded like, that that throws up barriers for any kind of development of this now for agricultural purposes.
But I gather there have been some people who actually have been buying, or have been able to to stake claims on some of this land. Is that correct?
Certainly, yeah. There's in right here in my area in St. Mary's, we have an Amish community, and these are people that like to you know, have small plots of land, smaller, you know, kind of mixed economy, mixed farm economy. It gets tougher and tougher down in our area to do that, as land is consolidated into larger holdings by larger farmers. So I know from my community, people that some Amish folks that moved up near North Bay and established themselves, started buying some properties up there, and now they've got a community up there. I was told about another Mennonite community that basically made a similar move further north up to Matheson, which is up into this area, that this great northern clay belt that we're talking about. And I mentioned in the article, like, this economic development officer basically said to me, the people that live in that area, when these these Mennonites came up about 8 years ago and started establishing themselves. Now these concessions that they're on now, they used to look like ghost towns, and now they're thriving, you know, mixed sort of industries related to agriculture.
Nice. But now you've said that there's economic development folks who would really like to see this land brought back into use. But as you said, I guess the question is, what are they able to do about it at this point, given the red tape that's involved?
Well, what they've come up with as a group of them along with some participation from the Ministry of Agriculture and Food and Rural Affairs in Ontario, and with some of the basically community groups in their area, is that they've come up with a survey that they are wanting to distribute to the owners of these lands, of trying to reach as many as they can of owners of properties deemed agricultural, deemed to be on, class 1, 2, 3 farmland. So basically they're hoping people will get in touch with them, will visit the website they've set up, do the survey, and will consent to them being able to, if they have interested buyers, that maybe they can help facilitate a connection between those people. If there's buyers that are interested in establishing themselves in an agricultural business, that maybe they'd be able to make connections. So that's their attempt now, is this survey that they've come up with, and hoping to get in touch with the owners of these properties. Mm-hmm. And they also are lobbying the government to try to ease the red tape a little bit on the conversion of Crown land to agricultural purposes as well.
Now, just as far as the attraction of the land, though, I gather there's not really a whole lot of infrastructure up there, though, to support large-scale commercial farming or ranching, though, is there?
Well, no, there isn't. Not compared to what I would be used to. Like, I did an article a while ago about a new, and it was a Ukrainian company that moved into North Bay and is building a meat processing plant.
Oh, yeah.
Now, their goal is to get a federal license to kill, but they haven't got to that point yet, and so they are going to have to, they're only processing at this point, and they're having to bring their meat up from the south, because that's the only kill plants, right? So, and that's in North Bay, that's at the very bottom of the area that we're talking about, so you just drive hours north, and there's one of the organizations that has been helping promote this is Beef Farmers of Ontario, because they're aiming to rebuild the beef herd in Ontario sort of decimated by mad cow, BSC, other factors, and they're hoping to rebuild, and they see this as an opportunity, Beef Farmers of Ontario does, but there's not a lot of infrastructure there. And it's not just beef farmers. It's the same for anybody that needs to get their products to market, right? Mm-hmm.
Now, with all that having been said, I mean, I'm not going to go into too much more detail because, of course, I want people to pick up the paper or go to farmterio.com and to read your article, of course. But what can you tell us about the dollars and cents? What's this land, what's this type of land in this location worth?
Well, I was told that a farmer from Alberta had relocated and was buying up or renting properties and had built up a couple thousand acres or a few thousand acres that he was farming, buying for $300 an acre. Where I am, it's $15,000 an acre. So.
Oh, wow.
I could buy quite a few acres too, I think, if I sold my farm here. So that's definitely a selling point. Like, if that is actually true, who knows, when you're talking about the price of land, you never know if you're getting straight goods, but that's a selling point. It is, like I said, this northern clay belt, good, it is fertile land. They've been deemed to be so. And there are programs available for draining, for tile drainage, which I think is definitely something people would want to be interested in. There has also been a study or some studies around the climate and just monitoring. There's been tracking of the heat units, crop growing heat units available in the region, and it's definitely increased over the last 30 years.
So with the heat units available, what could you grow up there?
I don't think you'd be getting into corn anytime soon, but there are some other crops, I think, that and like small grains, I'm sure, have been grown up there for years. It's mostly a lot of hay and pasture, obviously. Whether there be maybe some other crops like soybeans, canola, I think there's probably possibilities. Mm-hmm. But again, the challenge would be getting it to market.
Mm-hmm. But the land is definitely priced as a fixer-upper. I do hope we can keep an eye on that area and see what happens there in the not-too-distant future. Stu Slater, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Stu Slater is an organic dairy farmer and farm writer at St. Mary's, Ontario. Be sure to check out some of his recent work at farmterio.com. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Well, Statistics Canada decided to go the social distancing route this summer to prepare its latest production estimates using the satellite modeling system it usually uses to prepare its fall production report. Here to talk about the stats from StatsCan and much more, we have Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets with Glacier Markets Farm. Bruce, hi and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Welcome.
Now, let's start with StatsCan. Was there anything there that caused the grain trade to sit up and take notice?
Well, I think it certainly did provide a few surprises, but again, the trade was mostly expecting a large crop, and that's what we got out of this report. On the surprise side, I guess, it would be canola. Canola production essentially came in the same as last year. Now, in this report, Statistics Canada also did revise their 2019 and some 2018 estimates. So the canola estimate was increased by a little over 800,000 tons from their previous estimate back in the fall of 2019. But certainly that, I think, was the surprise. Most of the trade had been expecting a 20 million ton type crop and came in at 19.4 million tons. So that was the one feature. On the cereal side, again, large wheat crops expected, the durum crop up about 39% from last year to 6.9 million tons, and the spring wheat crop up to 25.9 million tons. Both of those crops would be the second largest on record after the 2013 production figures. So certainly large crops there. And good yields, I think, generally across most of the commodities that we produce in the prairies here. So that was, again, part of what everyone was expecting was a fairly large crop. I think there's concerns now as we move through the harvest season here whether those yields actually come up with these satellite estimates. But certainly we did see a dry finish to this crop year, which has, I think, pulled the yields down a little bit. But again, this is basically good news, good production in Western Canada.
But if the grain trade saw it coming, though, I mean, are these numbers likely to have any effect at all on prices as we see them today?
Actually, the prices since the report have been fairly positive. We've seen rallies in the futures markets for both canola, where we pushed nearby November contracts up above $500 a ton, and the deferred January contract up well above $500 a ton. So I think that we're seeing a fairly positive response. Spring wheat prices, the Minneapolis contracts also seen a rally here as we get into essentially what is the post-harvest period for the North American wheat crop, at least. And we're making good progress on the prairies in terms of our harvest progress. So certainly in the southern areas, we're seeing good progress as well. So again, this marketing period is now starting to be well underway with new crop positions being filled with the crops that have been just harvested.
Now, I gather there are also other factors, particularly in U.S. markets, that are also playing a fairly outsized role in canola markets, particularly right now?
Well, certainly we're seeing demand for soybeans to be very high. They're in their weekly sales report, generally speaking, it's been between 1.5 to 2 million tons of sales from the U.S., mostly to China, and we're also getting daily announcements of sales over, which are reported when they exceed 100,000 tons. So we're seeing strong demand for soybeans. Of course, the Brazilian soybean supplies have now shrunk to the point because they've been aggressively exporting since they harvested the crop back in February. Where now we're really looking at the U.S. or the North American supplies being almost the only game in town. So we're seeing strong demand. Again, the trade deal between China and the U.S. I think is helping here. So we're seeing good demand for soybeans, and crop conditions have been declining in the Corn Belt. It's August through early September period is critical for the soybean crop, and crop conditions have declined because it has been dry, especially in the western areas of the Corn Belt. So there's been a couple of positive factors there that have helped push canola higher, and that's occurred despite a fairly strong Canadian dollar.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the other U.S. markets right now, corn and soybeans, of course, you know, as you said, I mean, you know, the weather picture seems to have taken a turn for the worse there.
Yes. The overall conditions through the filling period for corn and through this pod formation period for soybeans has been very dry in some areas. Specifically in parts of northwestern Illinois into Iowa, where you've seen about between 25% and 50% of normal precipitation over the past 6 weeks. And that certainly has caused some issues with filling. Unlike western Canada, this region of the Corn Belt has received mostly normal temperatures to maybe even a little bit below normal temperatures as you move further east. So that has helped keep crops from really suffering severe stress. But again, this poor moisture over the past 6 weeks certainly is going to have an impact on the fill and the production of both the corn and soybean crops. And of course, you also have the impact of the derecho winds that we've been talking about for the past 2 to 3 weeks now. But certainly that did have an impact on the corn crops in parts of Illinois and Iowa as well.
Mm-hmm. I've just been seeing some devastating pictures out of that part of the world. But do we have any hard data yet on how that's affected the crops in that region of the U.S.?
Well, the only thing we can go by right now are the crop ratings, which again, for soybeans have dropped about 7% from the good to excellent category over the past month. We will get numbers from the USDA in about just a little bit over a week, and that's going to be the first test because those will be the first estimates post the winds that we saw in the U.S. Midwest, as well as give us a better idea as to how things, the dryness has been impacting soybean crops in the growing areas as well.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, getting back to StatsCan for a second, I was looking at the corn and soybean numbers, and it does seem that even though fewer acres have gone in, that the yields seem to be seem to be relatively well, and that in fact we're looking at some fairly decent corn and soybean crops in Ontario and Quebec and whatnot.
Yes, and again, the especially the corn areas in Ontario, or mostly in the southwestern part of the province, which is right adjacent to Michigan and Ohio growing areas. So those regions have received some reasonably good rainfall through the past month or so. So that has helped boost prospects in Ontario. The rains came actually, I think, just in the nick of time at the end of August for that region. So certainly we're looking at some good yield potential for the grain and soybean crops in southern Ontario. You could say the same thing as well in Manitoba. We've received rains for the filling of the corn and soybeans almost a little bit too late, but certainly we did see enough rainfall to help with the filling of both of those crops in Manitoba as well.
And it's something we'll keep watching the skies for, and of course watching as the crops start to come off. Bruce Burnett, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is Director of Weather and Markets for Glacier Markets Farm. That's all we have for Between the Rows this week, but we'll be back in a week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. I'd like to thank Alan Dawson, Stu Slater, and Bruce Burnett, our guests this week. Thanks for listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.